Smetana wrote two sets of pieces that he called Souvenirs of Bohemia in the form of polkas. The second set he dedicated to the woman who became his wife, and from that set, that was number one, played by András Schiff. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after 2 o'clock, and live here at the South Bank Centre, it's time now for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Bad. The violinist Elizabeth Volfish giving us a little taste of the sort of technical wizardry that made the composer of that music an internationally renowned phenomenon during his lifetime. His name is Pietro Antonio Locatelli, and he died 250 years ago next Sunday. He plays like an earthquake, declared one listener. Another noted how, as he raced up and down the neck of the violin, Locatelli left scarcely any space untouched. And several found the strange faces he pulled as he played so distracting that at times they said they were compelled to shut their eyes. Extrovert, uninhibited and rightly proud of himself, that was Locatelli then. A man in the Paganini mould who, after performing a particularly dazzling violinistic feat, would often throw his arms open wide and call out repeatedly, "Aha! What do you have to say about that?" But Locatelli was much more than an extraordinary performer. Here was a serious composer too, who may have been better known today had he not had the misfortune to have lived in an era already rich with musical giants, people like Vivaldi, Bach and Handel, all of whom were more or less his contemporaries. Born in 1695 in the northern Italian town of Bergamo, by the age of 14, Locatelli was already playing the violin in his local cathedral, and within a year he was granted permission to study in Rome, although not with old Corelli, as some books will tell you, but with one of his prestigious circle. It must have been an incredibly exciting time for a young musician to be in that city, so many performance opportunities in the homes and palaces of some of the great churchmen and aristocrats and some of the most wonderful, ravishing churches ever built. But let's hold it there for a moment and have some music. This is one of Locatelli's Concerti Grossi, the fourth of the set of 12 that make up his Opus 1. In some ways, these early works aren't unlike those of Corelli, or Geminiani for that matter, who was a contemporary of Locatelli and a pupil of Corelli. Structure-wise, a concerto grosso is all about alternating the musical material between a small group of soloists and then the rest of the orchestra. It was very much the established musical language of the time. But even in these earliest works, you do sometimes get the sense that Locatelli is giving us just a glimpse of the classical or gallant style to come. Here are the Raglan Players, directed by Elizabeth Volfish and Nicholas Kramer.
Thank you.
The Raglan Players, directed by Elizabeth Volfish and Nicholas Kramer, with Concerto Grosso in E minor, Opus 1, number 4, by Pietro Locatelli, who's the subject of today's programme, which, incidentally, is coming to you live from a kind of large glass pod thing on the terrace of London's South Bank Centre. And thanks to all of you, I can see through the glass, for coming along to join us. You can give me a little wave if you like. Well, we left the young Locatelli in Rome, carving out quite a reputation with his extraordinarily accomplished violin playing. From 1723, though, he pretty well drops off the historical radar for a few years, and information becomes quite scarce. All we know is that he crossed the Alps, spending some time in some of the great German courts in cities like Munich, Dresden, Berlin, Frankfurt, and Kassel. Then in 1729, he's in his mid-30s now, Locatelli moved to Amsterdam. Why there? Well, this was the place to be when it came to music publishing. All over the city, companies offered the very latest in printing techniques. Locatelli had already had dealings with the renowned firm Roger and Lucerne, who issued the Concerto Grosso that we've just sampled. And they were pioneers in the kind of state-of-the-art copperplate engraving that not only increased the quality and readability of the music on the page, but also kept costs low. It's quite an illustrious little club as well, with Roger being responsible for the carefully prepared works of Albinoni, Corelli, Handel, Vivaldi, Lully, Telemann, and just about everyone else you could think of. Furthermore, the company had a worldwide distribution. In short, it was a brilliant setup that undoubtedly helped Locatelli's career enormously. In fact, Amsterdam, with its network of canals and its cultured inhabitants, was where Locatelli was to spend the rest of his life. He founded a Collegium Musicum. He did quite a bit of teaching and took a proactive interest in the publishing of his own works, including this next piece, which comes from his Opus 2, published in 1732, 12 Sonatas for Flute and Continuo. And here, although he still operates within the traditional four-movement pattern, we sense the beginning of a really strong personal style. This is the second of the sonatas, and listen to the way Locatelli exploits virtually the entire range of the flute of the time. Thank you. music by Locatelli, his Sonata in D Major for flute and continuo, performed by Wilbert Haselzett on the flute, Tom Copeman, the harpsichordist, and the cellist Richter van der Meer. With such melodic lines, characterful rhythms, and lovely decorations, Locatelli's flute pieces were always going to be popular. In fact, the first edition sold out as fast as it was quickly, sold out so fast it was quickly reprinted. But it's his writing for his own instrument, the violin, for which he was most highly regarded in his own day and best remembered in ours. And our next music is a violin concerto of the highest quality. The concerto in G major, opus 3, number 9, seems to have been composed for a ceremonial occasion, possibly in Venice. It's one of the collection of violin concertos Locatelli dedicated to his Venetian patron Girolamo Lini, and published under the title L'Arte del Violino. It was, in effect, his manifesto in which he set out his views about the correct nature of music for the violin. In these works, Locatelli particularly emphasised the highest register of the violin's range and its lyrical qualities and its sheer agility, much in the style that was pioneered by Vivaldi. Typically, in three movements, fast, slow, fast, the first and third contain a capriccio, not quite what we've come to call a cadenza, but an extended piece of solo writing which, while testing the violinist to its limits, to his or her limits, also offers the soloist an opportunity to add his own improvised material before returning to the written score. And where you have the freedom of a cadenza, the theatre, if you like, well, you have the licence to show off just about any effect you fancy, and then some. Harmonics, double stoppings, trills and double trills, chords and arpeggios with wide fingering, all the tricks of the trade that were later adopted by the virtuosi of the Romantic era. And yet, also some of the most delicate and graceful writing as well. We're going to hear the third movement, which is marked Allegro Capriccio Allegro, part of a 2004 recording led by the virtuoso violinist Giuliano Carmignola. And here, the capriccio, far from being merely a spectacular show-off item, is a superbly sustained piece of polyphonic writing. So here's Carmignola with the Venice Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Andrea Marcon. Thank you. part of Locatelli's Violin Concerto in G Major, Opus 3, Number 9, the third movement, performed by Giuliano Carmignola with the Venice Baroque Orchestra, directed by Andrea Marcon. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, live in the glass pop-up studio at London's South Bank Centre as part of Radio 3's South Bank Residency. And if I just look over Richard the Engineer's shoulder, I can even see a few boats chugging along the Thames. It's almost like being at the seaside. So that kind of superb playing was what made Locatelli so very famous in his lifetime. And yet not all his contemporaries liked his sort of in-your-face virtuoso style. One Dutch listener described it as unbearable for delicate ears. Charles Burney declared that Locatelli's music excites more surprise than pleasure. And another Englishman, Thomas Dampier, who visited Amsterdam as part of the Grand Tour and heard Locatelli performing, wrote how he played with so much fury upon his fiddle that he must wear out some dozens of them in a year. One can see why the ever-shrewd Locatelli developed a lucrative sideline in selling violin strings. "He plays like the devil," wrote another observer, which you may recall is more or less what they said about Paganini a century later. Earlier on in the programme, we heard one of Locatelli's flute sonatas, and we'll dip into one of his violin sonatas now, the final movement of his sonata in E-flat major. It's marked Cantabile, and I like to think it's the kind of graceful but still slightly tricky piece he might have played in the Amsterdam House concerts he gave once he'd retired from public concert giving.
Thank you.
the third movement of Locatelli's Sonata in E-flat major for violin and continuo, opus 6, number 11, published in Amsterdam in 1737 and performed there by the suitably named Locatelli Trio. Elizabeth Volfish on the violin, Richard Tunnicliffe on the cello and on harpsichord, my old friend Paul Nicholson. And what a great sound they make. Well, we're moving towards the final piece in our little Locatelli fest. And although, as you may have gathered by now, he wrote no vocal music whatsoever, just a glimpse of what might have been, how he might have gone about it, can be heard in Il Pianto d'Arianna, The Tears of Ariadne, a violin concerto from his Opus 7 set published in 1741. The point is, although it's all instrumental, an orchestral piece in fact, it nevertheless assumes the form of a cantata for solo violin and orchestra, even to the extent of including passages that quite obviously imitate vocal recitative. The story of Ariadne, rescued from Crete by Theseus following his slaying of the Minotaur, then abandoned by him on the island of Naxos, was a familiar operatic one, so 18th century listeners to this wordless treatment of it would have needed no explanation. A gently pulsing opening, perhaps intended to represent Ariadne asleep, alternates with agitation as she awakes to discover that Theseus has disappeared. And from that point on, the mood swings follow the course of a typical Baroque love lament, weeping one moment, raging the next, and with moments of level-headed realisation in between. So, to end, this is Locatelli's Concerto in E-flat Major, Opus 7, Number 6, Il Pianto d'Arianna, The Tears of Ariadne, played by the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra under Ton Koopman. Our violinistic Ariadne is Margaret Faultless.
Locatelli's Concerto in E-flat Major, Opus 7, Number 6, Il Pianto d'Arianna, a purely instrumental depiction of Ariadne weeping over her lost Theseus. The Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra was directed by Tom Koopman, and Margaret Faultless was the solo violinist. Well, that's all for this week's Early Music Show. It's been quite fun presenting the programme from a glass pop-up pod and seeing all friendly faces outside, so thanks to you all for coming along. Next week, I'll be back here at the South Bank Centre in London for another live show, when I'll be introducing some highlights from last year's Utrecht Early Music Festival. I shall now get myself a sandwich and go and look at the river and sign a few autographs. Well, probably not. Until then, goodbye.
The Early Music Show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Lindsay Kemp. And as ever, you can listen again to this week's programme on demand for the next 7 days via the BBC Radio 3 website. Well, as Lucy has just mentioned, we are indeed live at the South Bank Centre here on BBC Radio 3. It's a beautiful, more or less sunny Sunday afternoon. Lots to do and see here. I've managed to tear myself away from the food market outside and also from the fascinating display just around the corner from here about the history of this site and the Festival of Britain. I must go back and have a look at that in a minute. I'm joined now by Sarah Moore-Peach. She's managed to tear herself away from the cycling machine of sport relief fame. Sarah, am I allowed to mention this?
Well, yes,
I just
you're
have.
Allowed to mention it. Yes, I cycled and ran 12 miles for sport relief wearing a Radio 3 T-shirt last week.
Well done.
It went practically unnoticed, but I'm sure some people have donated some money, so that'll make it all worthwhile.
I'm sure they have. There was a splendid photo of you and Petrock in the same glass box.
Yes, we egged each other on.
Well done. You don't know how much off the top of your head you've managed to raise.
I don't know how much we raised, no,
you
but my thighs will never be the same again.
OK, moving on. You're here to tell us about the choir, which is coming live from here in about an hour's time. There's an even larger number of people outside the studio than when I arrived a couple of hours ago. I think most of them are singing on your programme, aren't they?
Several of them are singing on our programme, yeah. Well, we couldn't really be at the South Bank without involving their Voice Lab initiative, which is an extraordinary choral initiative, which we'll be hearing a lot about. They'll be singing some Duraflay for us. We're also going to be catching up with something which happened earlier, just a few hours ago, over in the Claw Ballroom, the other side of the foyer of the Festival Hall. Bellowhead, members of Bellowhead, Andy Mellon and Pete Flood, wrote a fantastic piece based on the Wondrous Machines, which are these fantastic, zany organs that have been built out in the foyer as well.
I must go and have a look at that.
And the choir was singing that. So there's that. My choral classic at 5 is a Vivaldi Gloria. We've got a choir at 4:30 from Scotland telling us about their amateur group Meet My Choir, which is a regular feature. We've got lots of listener requests and new releases as well. And some watery music as well to accompany Lucy on her stroll down by the Thames.
Very appropriate. Thank you very much. That's the choir with Sarah Moore-Peach, as I say, on the hour in an hour from now on the air. In an hour from now at 4 o'clock, and that'll be followed by this week's Words and Music, also coming live from the South Bank Centre, and that takes British Rivers as its theme. That's at 5:30. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 3 o'clock, and time for Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast last Wednesday, the feast of St Joseph of Nazareth, and came live from Wells Cathedral. The canticles date from the 16th century. The Magnificat on the fifth tone by Hieronymus Praetorius is preceded by an organ prelude by Andrea Gabrielli, and the Nunc Dimittis on the third tone is by Tomás Luis de Victoria. The anthem Josef Fili David by the Spanish-Mexican 17th century composer Juan Gutiérrez de Padilla is based on words from the first chapter of Matthew's Gospel and tells how an angel appeared to Joseph to assure him about the birth of Jesus. The service opens now with Victoria's motet, O Quam Gloriosum. Oh, how glorious is the kingdom in which all the saints rejoice with Christ.
Thank you. make speed to save us. Who then is the faithful, wise servant whom his master will set over his household? Welcome to Wells Cathedral and to Choral Evensong on this feast day of St. Joseph of Nazareth. In Joseph, we recognize the patron saint of the supporting role. His yes to God lies hidden behind Mary's and reminds us that our life in God is never just about the partial realms of the seeable and knowable. Evensong continues with the proper psalms appointed for today, Psalms 1 and 112.